Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey guys.
Good day.
Good guest.
I'm excited
about
this guest. Good guest. I got my spritzer with pink lemonade here.
Drink of the week.
Drink of the week.
Our guest this week, Rachel Kadzi-Ganza. You guys maybe got to know her through that piece she wrote about Dave Chappelle in The Believer.
Yeah. That piece was great.
Yeah.
She had another piece out a few weeks ago.
She's had a couple, yeah. Her latest thing out is this piece in VQR that is really unlike any story I've ever read in a magazine. It's one sentence. But it's very, very long. And she was just great. She's only been doing this work for a couple of years, which is really different than most people we've had on. And she's really working like on a very specific idea that she's attacking from all these different angles. And I had a really good time. It's really fun to meet her and get her in and get her talking about her stuff.
Would we have any sponsors this week?
We have just the one, Aaron, and it's a pop quiz. You don't know. Who do you think it is?
Laphroaig Scotch.
Yes.
Evan just proposed that we pretend that we were sponsored by a Scotch company in a way to subtly suggest that we'd like Scotch sponsorship.
Now you've ruined it. Now you've fucking ruined it. Who is our sponsor this week?
It's Tiny Letter. It's a tiny letter. It's a simple, elegant way to send an email newsletter. It's done by the good people of MailChimp, and we thank them for their sponsorship.
Here's Max and Rachel Kadzi-Ganza.
Hello, Rachel Kadzi-Ganza.
Hello, Max.
It is good to see you.
It's good to see you.
All right, I'm just gonna get right to it. Here's the thing. I had never read anything by you, and then in October, the new issue of The Believer came out. And it had this piece on Dave Chappelle, and I was like a big Dave Chappelle fan, and I was really excited to read it, and I didn't really know what you could write about Dave Chappelle 10 years after he left his show, but I thought, well, you know, if The Believer is going to spend whatever it was, 7,000 words on it or whatever, it's got to be something there, right? It's got to be something interesting, and I don't know, maybe I should like play it closer to the vest or something, but holy shit, that story was amazing.
Thank you.
I just sat there and like read it all in one sitting, and the thing that was I guess it's not super surprising because you're a pretty major character in the story, but I read it and I was just like, I wanted to know. I felt like I knew a lot about Chappelle at the end, but I wanted to know more about you, and so it's been a long time coming, but I'm really happy to have you on the show, and I want to talk to you about Chappelle.
I'm happy to be here.
That was like a very long preamble, but
it's
here we go. All right, so. Can we just talk about that story for a little bit? We'll get into like your whole history and all this other great stuff that
sure.
You've written, but tell me about the genesis of that story. Why do it? Why write about it then? How did it come about?
It came about because Carolina, and I'm going to mangle her last name and I don't want to because she's so wonderful. Wakasia?
Sounds right to me.
Okay. She is a novelist in her own right and a phenomenal editor. Approached me and said, do you want to write for The Believer? And I said, yeah, sure. And she said, do you have any ideas? And somehow Chappelle came up. I mean, I don't know if it was my idea or her idea or whatever. And we initially thought that it would be a very different sort of profile, just a straight ahead profile where you actually have access to the source. And then very soon into the process, I realized the idea of having access to the source was going to be a bust. So, you know, I laid in bed and cried and wallowed for a little bit. And then I decided, well, what else is there to say? And I had been doing all this research. And what I realized is that Chappelle had kind of already stated why he left. And so it could just be an issue of explicating and exploring that more. And so that's what I started to do. And
so you didn't want to talk to him about what he was doing now or what he was going to do next, but you wanted to talk to him about leaving the show.
Yeah.
That was the thing you were interested in.
Yeah, because I thought that was probably the most powerful act of autonomy that I had seen coming of age from a black artist. And one that really stood out to me because it was basically like, you know, and he says this about Rick James, but like, fuck your couch.
Yeah.
So I wanted to know where he got the chutzpah to make a move like that. And I started to do this research and I realized that his mother was this brilliant Pan-African scholar and a Unitarian minister. I think actually she's the first black female Unitarian minister in America, which I don't think made it into the profile.
There you go.
So she was just a really interesting person. She had spent time with Lumumba, working to establish a government in the Congo. And I started to see that the makings of the sort of man who could say no to all of this money had long been there. And then that was the piece for me.
It's a pretty incredible move to like approach someone about writing a profile. And they're like, no, I've said all I want to say. I'm not going to do it. And you're like, okay, but I'm going to call your mom.
Well, no. What happened is that I actually told her initially, you know, I approached this and he wasn't interested. But in some ways, the piece kind of becomes a piece about hers, which is what I told her. I'm really more interested at this point about you, Professor Seyon, because she, to me, embodied so much of what Black America was doing intellectually during the 60s, and also the sense that you never take yourself out of theory when you're talking about our culture, you know, because the lived consequences of that stuff, they're all so close.
A lot of people were interested in why he left the show, but had any of those people gone to her before? I mean, had anyone asked her what she thought?
I don't know. I guess one thing that I should say is that my mother was a professor, kind of that ilk. And so I was interested in Kanye West, whose mother was a professor. And I was interested in these people who are deeply influenced by what their parents did during the 60s and 70s. And I know I was. And so I wanted to see the influence that she had on him. But I'm also very interested in the sense that people try to take Black America so much out of context. I wanted to fill in the context.
Right. There's so much in that piece about going back through the sort of history of Black comedy and Pryor and
Fetch It,
Gregory.
Pryor.
Can you just kind of walk me through like the process of not just writing that piece, but reporting it? Like, did you always think you were going to go talk to Dick Gregory, or was that something that, like, you know, your curiosity just led you to?
I started to think about the N-word in comedy a lot, and it's a word that I'm uncomfortable with, deeply uncomfortable with. And so, you know, that idea of a lacuna, the thing that there's a gap in the story or hole missing or something. I said, well, this is something that's fascinating to me. Let me figure out what the N-word means in this situation. Right. So I knew that Dave Chappelle had used this word a lot and there was discomfort about him using this word. And so I wanted to see what the origins of that sort of language was. And so, you know, I started watching Pryor obsessively. You know, I started watching George Carlin obsessively. And just watching obscene comedy obsessively, which was so weird because, I was
Did you find, like the jokes you were telling started to change? Like,
yeah, they did. Yeah, yeah. And like, they still, I don't think I've ever recovered from that. People still like, what? You know? I got into a conversation with a friend and I was saying things, off the wall things. And I was like, what's wrong with you? And I was like, I love comedy. That stuff doesn't fly in real life. So I was interested in what those guys were doing, and I was just interested in Twain always. I mean, Twain has always been, Mark Twain's always been such a hero of mine. I just think he's one of the best ever to do it. And so I wanted to connect all of this stuff about how you can provoke the culture and how America's constantly been provoked in a weird way by comedy.
As you're going through it, like what you just described could also be a book, right? I mean, there's a lot there, like the history of comedy. This is like it's a big, broad topic.
It's a broad topic.
So, how do you find a way to weave in this, like, I mean, all of your work, you go into this like kind of like deep historical stuff, and it is about placing kind of like current pop culture figures or whatever in this larger context and connecting them to the whole history of entertainment, Black entertainment. How do you find a way to weave that in and out?
So usually what happens is that I start to do too much research. And, you know, I often say this, that as a woman, and especially as a Black woman, I'm often troubled by a sense of being inauthentic, or what right do I have to say these things? And I think that that's a bad thing, obviously. But usually the way it manifests itself is that I end up thinking, well, let me do the work. Let me just go and sit in the stacks and do the work and do the research and see what there is to know, which is not to say that I come out being omniscient and all-knowing or anything, but it is to say that I'm interested in the effort of doing that work, and I like to see where it leads me. And if it leads me to things that seem connected, I like to tie them together.
Where'd you land with Chappelle? Like, if you went into it wondering how he got the chutzpah, to say no to $50 million.
Right.
What was your answer?
I think I landed that he got it, obviously, from his mother and his father. And he got it from the sense of, I don't need you all, you know? And I think that that's something that America's not used to seeing from Black performers, is the sense that I'm not performing for you, perhaps. Like, it's not about you. So just take yourself out of...
Or maybe I am and I don't want to be.
Right. Or maybe I've been perverted into being that way and I know better. And so the sense that you can have autonomy and you can have control and you can have, you can control your interest. And I mean, and that to me is the one large story that I think, I see all of the work as being interconnected. So I like to write about people who are creating new models for the way that we see Black art, Black performance, Black literature. I just see it as one long chain of a conversation. And I try to write about people that I love and also people that I admire. And I think people who are showing us, I can do it my way.
Yeah, I mean, that comes through. Like, I don't think, I've just reread all your stuff. And I don't think there's anything in there where it's like, there's no takedowns.
No. I can't even imagine writing a takedown.
So is part of what you're trying to figure out, like, why you love these people?
Yes, it definitely is a curiosity. I mean, or figuring out why we all love these people, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, Chappelle, my sense was that people love him because he did that in a weird way. And that we all hopefully hope that we can all do that one day, right? That we can all have balls, you know? Like, who wouldn't? I mean, I don't want to say that word. But, I mean, that we all can have the sense of, I don't need you. I can do what I want to do. And I don't have to compromise myself, just to be uncompromised. And I just thought he was this great, great, great figure for that. And we don't have a lot of figures for that.
So even though he said no, you still went to his town in Ohio?
Right.
Did you go before he said no?
No. I went after he said no, but I was also invited there by someone, so.
Oh, so you had an excuse.
Yeah, I didn't just, like, go to his town in Ohio. I don't have those tendencies.
Not the creep reporting style.
No, I tend to be very, you know, I try to be respectful because I think at the end of the day, these people deserve respect. I mean, I'm the weirdo who, when I send around interview requests, I still try to say, you know, Mrs. whatever, Mr. whatever, because there is a distance in the sense that these people do give us a piece of their lives. And there's, you know, I do feel like one should be grateful for that. And that could come from working in the music industry, the sense that you see all the effort that goes into getting up on stage 24/7 and making someone else's day better. It requires, I think, a lot of work and a lot of generosity. And I think in response to that, there can be some gratitude. I mean, and that doesn't mean you write a hagiography, and that doesn't mean that you go easy on a person, but that does mean you see the work.
And you try and sort of empathize with where they're at.
If not empathize, acknowledge it, at the very least.
The end of the piece, I don't care if anyone hasn't read it yet, I'm just spoiling it. But the end of the piece, you're in Chappelle's hometown in Ohio.
Right.
And run into him at a coffee shop.
Right.
And decided not to say hello. Not like tell him who you are, working on this thing. Do you regret that at all?
No, because he had already told me he didn't want to do an interview. So what else is there to talk about? I mean, me being a pest? You know, isn't that the point? The point is he's stated all he needs to say, and he wanted that to be it. And so there was no conversation to have. I think also it has to do with, I'm sort of like an outrageous, shy person. Like, I have the, like, duality in that way of, I find myself in situations where Dick Gregory is emphatically correcting me over the phone. but at the same time, it's not my inclination to push too hard on people I don't know.
But it also ended up being kind of a fitting end to your story.
I hope it was.
Did you ever hear anything? Like, he must have read it.
I don't know.
Here's the crazy thing, reading through all your stuff. There are more like book references and just like general like need for a bibliography than like anything I've ever read. It did make me feel like I need to read a lot more. I missed a lot of it.
Should read less.
I don't know, but I mean, you seem like a pretty strong reader. Have you always been reading a ton?
No.
So you got a book on the table?
Yeah,
right
I have
now.
A book on the table. I'm reading Room Full of Mirrors, the biography of Jimi Hendrix. I like to read because I don't think I know a lot. I also could not read until I was 12. And so my mom would get all of these awful notes home for the short stint that I went to Catholic school saying, it's highly unlikely this girl will go to college. And so I always felt really terrible. You know, when your mom comes home crying from teacher-parent conferences, it gives you a sort of determination. Like, I can do this. I can read. So that I think that that's one thing. But
was there something like that clicked? How did that just happen?
I really don't know. I think it's horrible to say that because it is one of those things that couldn't have been effortless. But someday it felt like I just woke up and I could read. And I just started to read constantly.
Yeah, making up for lost time.
I had to make up for lost time, definitely. Often I just read because I think I don't know enough about something. Or I actually love the sentences. And I pay a lot of attention. I think that that's my obsession with music, just to the melody of sentences. And so my favorite writers, I think, have a musicality to them.
Who are the people that you were reading?
That I always return to?
Yeah.
Joan Didion. She's my absolute, I mean, that's cliche, but she's, if I met her, I think I would melt into a puddle at her feet. Really like Hunter S. Thompson. I really like Gay Talese. Really love Toni Morrison.
There's some like Frank Sinatra had the cold aspects to that Chappelle story.
Only in the sense the center is missing.
Yeah.
You know, the profile that I was really, really interested in as a model, not a model, but a frame maybe, was Hunter S. Thompson, Why Did Hemingway Move to Ketchum?
I don't think I've ever read that.
Okay, so it's like, I think he wrote this maybe early into his career, Hunter S. Thompson.
It's another reference I'm missing. This is my experience of
reading. He goes to Ketchum, Idaho, I guess, right? And he interviews Hemingway's neighbors and trying to piecemeal together who this man was. I stumbled across it and I thought, this is fantastic. This is what you do.
Yeah.
When you can't get access to someone, you go around, you go to their house, and you talk to their neighbors.
Okay, so where are you born?
I was born in Indiana. My mom's a geographer, so we moved around a lot.
Your mom's a geographer?
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Yeah, what does a geographer do in 2014?
Okay, so a geographer isn't mapping. It's not a cartographer.
Right.
Right, so she's not exploring new places. Usually what they're doing is mapping space, which there's still lots to do in the sense of
some work up there.
GIS, right? So mapping landscapes we don't know about, and then mapping known worlds, or known quantities. And so why does Philadelphia, for example, turn into North Philadelphia at some parts, and the Northern Liberties at other parts, depending on year to year? Like what happens in that space that alters neighborhoods and that sort of stuff. So that's what she does.
Do you and she talk about books when you're growing up?
Was that part of, once you started reading?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, yes. And she always had a ton of books. So it was, I feel like I was just always, there was an attempt to maybe play catch up so we could talk more. You know, I think one of the amazing things about having a mom who's so smart and active was that I always felt like, wow, we could have these wonderful conversations, but I couldn't read until I was 12. So the moment I started to read, it was like, I could read all these books and we could talk on another level. And so she had a great library.
So, all right, so you're like coming back to Didion and Hunter S. Thompson and these folks, and how'd you start actually writing for publications? Because you've done a bunch of other stuff. You worked with The Roots for a long time. You wrote about that experience?
Yep, wrote about that.
How did that happen? How did it come about?
How did that come about? I met a NPR producer named Steve Rowland when I was, you know, quite young. I guess I was 17 at a career day. And I kind of knew that I wasn't going to go to college immediately. And so I was hustling, you know, like, what am I going to do next? And I told him I love music, you know. And he said, well, yeah, you know, there's this guy in Philly. He's a great guy. You should talk to him. And it turned out that this guy was the manager of The Roots, who I already loved The Roots, you know. I had seen Black Thought, who was the rapper, in a grocery store when I was quite young with a group of my friends. And we'd followed him around through this grocery store, like, you know, rhyming his lyrics as he walked around getting, like, rice and soy and whatever he was shopping for. He's vegetarian. And he later on, when I started working for them, he was like, I remember that. And I had never been followed by a group of 14-year-old girls rapping my lyrics before. And he's like, it stood out. So, you know, I've been constantly.
He must have been like kind of excited and kind of creeped out.
Creeped out, yeah, you know. So I got set up with Rich, and I remember I went and I met him at a club in Philadelphia.
How old are you?
I was 18 or so. And we talked about music, and at that point I thought I knew a lot about jazz and music. I did not. He was gracious enough and kind enough and adventurous enough to say, hey, yeah, you can come and work with us for a short period of time. And then it turned into longer and longer and longer. And
what were you doing?
At first I signed on like just to be an intern, and then it became, you know, you want to write, try to write some stuff for us. You know, I freaked out. It's like, not lyrics, just ideas they had. And then,
like what kind of stuff? Like liner notes?
No. Rich had some idea about movies or something he wanted written. I think I wrote that down on a legal pad, which is just so unhelpful. You know, I was like kind of a pre-millennial generation where it seemed like it was an option to still do something on pencil and paper, right, you know, and for everyone else who was moving in a world faster than the one I had just left, which was high school.
Right.
It's like, just use the computer, you idiot. So I did that. And then it was like, no, you know, I'm going to become a producer. And so he let me help out with the Black Lily, which was a series they had. And so I did that for a little while, and that was cool. And then I just sort of moved on.
How do you get to writing?
How did I get to writing? So I met Lewis Lapham.
Just walking down the street?
No. I went to a Thorstein Veblen conference. I was really into that stuff my senior year of college. Went to a conference. Lewis Lapham was there. I think it was like 20 people. And I was blown away. One, by his style. The man has immense style.
Yeah, the man can dress.
The man can dress. I mean, let's talk about tailoring and bespoke clothing and just, he has a lot of swag. So I was impressed by that. And then the second thing is that everything he said to me was like profound. It was deeply profound. He was talking to these sort of stodgy guys who'd come up to see Lewis Lapham talk. And I kept chiming in. And then finally he was like, hey, you know, you're a weirdo. I'm like there being me. And he said, what are you up to? And I said, you know, I want to be a writer, I think. And he had this amazing leather notebook. I had just never seen quality things like this, I think. You know, I felt like his glasses were real tortoiseshell. And he wrote down my name in his notebook, and he said, you should be a Harper's intern. And I thought, okay. And we smoked Parliaments, and he smokes those, you know, a lot. And I thought, that's the end of that. Like, who is going to go home?
But you were in the notebook, the leather notebook.
Well, 2 weeks later, I got a huge envelope with the Harper's application. And I thought, I have to fill this out, you know? I mean, it shows up. I mean, I don't think he went through the effort of printing it all, but he had had someone do it. And that was amazing to me. I mean, yeah. I had read Harper's before, and more so, though, I've always been a huge admirer of Lewis Lapham for some. I like history. I like historians. And him sending that to me was a great vote of confidence. And so I filled it out, and I got it.
That's a legendary internship. I feel like half the people on this podcast have had that internship at some point.
They say it's like that. Like, it's a huge deal.
So, yeah. So you did your Harper's internship. And then what happens? What's like the first, what was the first published piece you had?
The first piece I wrote was a piece about Jay-Z in the New York Observer. Christian Lorentzen, who's now at the London Review of Books, was the editor. He had been working at Harper's for a long time and moved over to the Observer, and we talked, and I don't think Harper's does a lot of pop culture stuff, so he said, let's try to do something here. And I was I'm always really interested in capitalism and capital. So we started to talk about Jay-Z, and the thing that interested me most was, how was Jay-Z going to make the transition from talking about selling crack to being a sort of elder statesman in the scene?
Yeah.
Especially since I feel like, you know, hip-hop is not very accommodating for aging.
Yeah, for old
right,
men.
Right. Yeah. So I was interested, like, how are these guys going to talk about balding and wearing button-ups and, like, vacationing in the Hamptons without seeming like someone's grandfather? And I was also just really interested in how aspiration works, right? Because a lot of what Jay-Z peddles is this sort of, God, wealth is so great. which for most of the people would be obnoxious, but I think he strikes this sort of American quality of like, let me tell you how I made it from the bottom to the top and it feels so good. And I wanted to see how long he could keep doing that.
Right, before it's like, I don't really remember the bottom anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I don't care anymore. You've been rich for 30 years.
Yeah, the top has been consistently great for a while
yes.
now.
Yeah. Right. And so we're still wondering, you know, how long he's going to be able to do that. But at the time, I was
this is like right when his Dakota came out, right?
It was right when Dakota came out. And I was interested, what does it mean to become an author, right? Even though he'd been one, I think I see anyone who writes anything down as being an author. But what does it mean to author into your existence?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that came up in that RZA piece you wrote, too. It's about, like, rappers trying to write their autobiographies. And there's something in there about, like, Jay-Z did it and then canned it.
What I've read is that he had a more first-person narrative of, like, let me take, like, a Bildungsroman, where he's like, let me take you from my boyhood to my maturation, and this is how I did it.
Right.
And then he said, like, this was too confessional. What I liked about the RZA was that he was so confessional, and I hadn't really seen a lot of moments in hip-hop where people talk about, yeah, there was that moment when I was on top of the world, but my girlfriend cheated on me, and I felt emasculated, and I had to go and lay in the grass and cry. So I just thought, wow, this is profound, and I was deeply riveted, and I wanted to talk about that and just think about it.
The RZA one was in
Transitions, which is one of my favorite magazines, and everyone should read them.
Yeah, I didn't know Transitions before I started reading your stuff.
Right. No, they've been around for, I think, 60 years now, and they've published everyone. I mean, their board of directors is just sick. But it's based out of Harvard, and Henry Louis Gates is sort of the publisher, and they've published everyone. Sharifa Rhodes Pitts, and then back and forth, you know, Edward Said and Wole Soyinka. So I love that magazine.
So ran for them. Capital. You wrote this great piece about Kendrick Lamar that was in LA Review of Books. Chappelle thing was in The Believer. This is like a true freelancing.
Yeah, yeah. I like freelancing because I like being a journeyman to all these like editors and figuring out how places work, and some places you like more than others, and the places that are really great, like The Believer. I just, deep affection.
A lot of time when people come on, freelancers come on, they talk about just like kind of how exhausting it is, like the pitching and like having to just manage all this stuff. And you know, I know a lot of people who freelance for a while and then were just kind of like, I can't do this anymore.
Right.
Maybe I'm gonna stop writing. Did you like give yourself like a window?
For what?
For how long you're gonna do it for before you're gonna try and go
I'm
get a
staff? I'm still freelancing. Job. I mean, like I'm doing a piece now about a space, not a person in New York City, and I like it. I guess I've never thought of having a boss, so
yeah, not having a boss is pretty appealing,
you know. So like one of the things I like to say is like I've been boss free since 1999, so I never think about it as, you know, freelancing. Yeah, it is sort of exhausting. I'm grateful because I have to do maybe less pitching now, so that's cool. But one thing that I think is good is that you learn to write different things. So, you mm-hmm. know, if I'm writing a memoir piece, it's very different from writing a profile or so on and so forth. And so I like that sort of variety. I took a class with Errol MacDonald in graduate school. One of the things he said is that, you know, if you want to be a writer, you should be able to write in any form. And so it's good to see if one can do that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a piece that you had in the new VQR that was really unlike anything I had read in that magazine or kind of any magazine.
What's one sentence?
Yeah, for example. can you describe that story and then we can talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, that was a piece that's very dear to me. It was about my grandfather and his life in Louisiana. And he got into an unfortunate incident one night or one evening with a guy, and he had to leave. And so the reason I thought about keeping it one sentence is that my entire life, all of the stories about my family felt so disparate. Like, it felt like, are disconnected, right? Like, this piece is over here, and that piece is over here. And I think that that's really true of Black American culture, that we don't know sometimes how we arrived at this point, right?
And you've caught some shit from your family for just writing about it at all, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So what I wanted to do, and not my grandfather. My grandfather, who passed away in October, hugely wanted me to tell his story. And he was a great teller of stories, right? So he would tell me these stories where he would say, you know, Nat Turner's our cousin. Harriet Tubman is our cousin. And I would sit there and I would just be, you know, blown away by this sense of connectivity that everything could be related to us. And we had no bounds and we were the most incredible people who'd walk the earth. And what I realized is that that's a really, really old form of storytelling in the Black community. And so I wanted to capture that. And I love Greek mythology. So I wanted to give it this sense of the makings of someone or of people. And this is how they come to be. And what if you could tie it all together so that you realize the reason why we didn't have fathers in my family was tied to a single act.
Right, one night.
One night, right? And I think that also expresses just how difficult it is to be someone who's marginalized in America. It doesn't take much for your night to go completely wrong, right? Like Trayvon Martin goes out to get a piece of candy and a juice and he dies, right? So I wanted to sort of capture the immense vulnerability that exists for us and at the same time the immense strength and an ability to tie in all of these broken fragments or all these fragments that were attempted to be broken into one story. And that was the sort of aim.
The whole thing is in your grandmother's voice.
Right.
Is she still alive?
No, they both passed about 2 years apart from each other.
So you wrote the whole thing from memory in her voice?
No, I did not write the whole thing from memory. And that's the amazing thing. My grandparents both let me record them. And so this whole time I was working, I have one piece of him telling me that story, and then I have another piece of her telling me that story. And then I have all these deep memories of my childhood sitting in her bed, literally, and that's how it begins. And her telling me about Louisiana, because my grandmother moved to Philadelphia. Well, she didn't move to Philadelphia. She moved in with us when I was born. So she was deeply Southern. I mean, she was an entrenched Southern lady, and she had accent and customs and ways of doing things. And they were all very real for me, right? You know, I could go in my grandma's room and feel like I was in the Deep South. And I could leave my grandmother's room and I was in Philadelphia, right? Right. And then I was dealing with all this other crazy shit. But that sort of room was a hothouse for me in terms of language and stories and a connection pretty much to the 20th and 19th century, right? And I wanted to get that. I wanted to nail their voices. And she had this extremely elegant Southern voice. And I just wanted to say that those people had the best language I've ever heard.
It's a beautiful piece. It was, like I said, it was kind of unlike anything I'd read before. You were literally like sitting there with tape recorders?
They would tell me the stories. I would go back later and say, Grandpa, tell me about the night you left Louisiana. And then he would tell me the story, and it would, he was my hero, my grandfather. And I think that really he influences everything I write about, because I'm always interested in people who don't accept what other people think about them and do it their own way. And he was just the forefather of that sort of energy for me.
You feel like you do that? Do it your own way? Don't worry about people think?
I'm not there yet.
When you're writing these stories, do you have an audience in mind? Do you care what readers think?
No.
Who are you thinking when you put this story up? No one.
That would be paralyzing. I wouldn't know what to do. It's already paralyzing to me because often I'm coming to it and I'm looking at like 50 sources and I'm like, how are you going to get that in there? If I was thinking about other people, that would be crazy.
But you do want people to read your stuff.
It's cool. I mean, you know, I don't want people not to, I don't want to publish it and not be read. But at the same time, it isn't a request line.
Right. You know? Right. The only person you're trying to satisfy is yourself.
Yeah.
You write all your own titles?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Aggressively write your own titles?
Aggressively.
You did an interview on Gawker, which I tried, I did not read before this because I didn't want to just ask all the same questions that were on right there. But I know what it's called. It's called Stakes is High. Why was it called Stakes is High?
Stakes is High, right. So Gawker commenters get very mad because they don't know De La
it's
Soul.
It's a running theme on this show.
Yeah,
it's,
right. Oh,
Gawker
really?
Commenters get
yeah,
very
it's
mad.
Like, you don't know a De La Soul album? Don't talk to me.
Best De La Soul album.
Well, you know, it's like, you don't know stakes is high. What conversation can we have? The reason I called it that was because one of the things that I'm always thinking about is that I'm very close to my family in Louisiana. Have a deep source of a deep sense of admiration about them, and they're the most amazing people. Because I have some cousins who are huge, big shots in terms of being lawyers, and I have other cousins who are in Angola prison serving life. So, what I think people think about Black culture that sort of disturbs me is the sense that we can ever get away from some of the inequities that this country has served up. So for me, I don't ever feel like I can be removed from any conversation, right? I don't think I can be removed from talking about underemployment, which I feel like the Kendrick Lamar piece was about. I don't think I can be removed from talking about prisons. I don't think I can be removed from talking about the things that I face because they're in my family. Like, this is my this is my real life, right? It's my real life that I have cousins who are scared to drive where they live because they know cops disproportionately follow them. So the stakes are high. I'm not just writing this to write. I'm writing because I think there's something I need to say. And there's something that needs to be said. And you sort of mentioned earlier, well, there aren't a lot of people doing this, you know, within my particular demographic. Well, even more reason than I shouldn't waste that opportunity.
And that's why you think it's important to write not just about pop culture in this sort of historical context, but also this kind of intimately personal stuff about your family.
Yeah, the intimately personal stuff about my family is my way of saying whatever happens to you is happening to me because we're a family and we're a community. And I think that that's the way I view it. And I think the next piece that I really, 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 really want to write is about my cousin who's serving life in Angola as a non-violent offender. And he's my age. And so when you know, the last time I was near Angola, I went and I tried to visit him. And I wasn't allowed because I hadn't put the right paperwork together. But I put money on his commissary. And one of the things I noticed was that we're the same age, but he's going to serve the rest of his life behind bars. And that to me was just earth shattering and really heartbreaking. And so I feel very close to all of these stories. And I don't see myself as writing about pop culture, really. I just write about Black people. And so whatever situations we find ourselves in, these people are just lenses to a larger conversation.
Were you close with your cousin?
You know, it's really interesting. I was not close to my cousin, but my other cousin, who I am quite close to, she told me something. And one thing that happens is I didn't grow up in Louisiana and they all did, which is just, you know, the great migration in that way. One thing she told me is that you have to understand this guy is a master fisherman, a master hunter, a master at all of these things that have been made obsolete. And so if everything that you do well isn't desired, you turn to whatever things you can do.
What's he in prison for?
Three strikes, you're out.
Jesus.
Right. So the story that I'm always trying to tell about my family is the story of flukes. Like how flukes can change the next 100 years or the next 50 years or the next 10 years. And the story I'm trying to tell in my profiles is about how new models come to life. So I guess I saw this thing that someone said, you know, don't let your struggle become your identity. So there's, I agree. But at the same time, there is struggle. So I try to write about, in one element of my life, the struggle. And the triumph. And then in another segment of my life, I try to write about the vanguards. Because what I hope is that a young kid or an older person will see that you have choices or that you don't have to accept what people hand to you and say, this is your existence. you have some control over that. It's something I kind of lifted from Patti Smith, who says in Just Kids, when I was a journalist, I only wrote about people I loved, and I interviewed her recently. And I said, you know, that's one of the reasons I went into this, because I thought, if you write about people you love, you give them their due.
Right, but it seems like maybe you're also like writing for people you love.
Yes, definitely.
Not anyone specific, because I know you're not thinking about anyone when you're writing.
Right, yeah.
But you are writing for people who look like you. That's like a phrase that you come back to.
I often say that. I like the idea that...
There's kids in your classroom.
Yeah, I like the idea that kids in my classroom can learn that I understand why you're mad, I understand why you're sad, and let me show you some people who triumph.
It's interesting. I interviewed Leslie Jamison. Have you read any of her stuff?
Yeah.
I interviewed Leslie Jamison a couple months ago, and you know, she wrote this kind of like disparate group of essays that then came together in a book, and it kind of turned out there was like a sort of theme running through all of them.
Right.
And your work feels kind of similar to me in that, like, these like focus on these pop culture figures, Beyonce or Kendrick Lamar, whoever, tie it back through historical context. Is that like is that a thing that you want to keep doing? Are there more people you want to write about in that way?
Yes, so many more people. You know, basically, the way I always thought about this was just crazy, I guess, is I had already conceived of the themes, you know? They're all mapped out. I don't want to say I mapped out a book, but I already knew who I was going to write about, who was doing the work that I was interested in, and the big work that I was interested in. And sometimes new things pop out at me, but for the most part, I know the things that I want to write about.
Who's next on the list? Can you tell me?
Well, let's talk. Next on the list is not a person, it's a place.
All right. Well, that's like...
Right. So it's...
That's mysterious enough.
Right. You know, I like Didion. I love the thing that she did on Central Park in the Central Park case. Mm-hmm. My mom's a geographer, so I'm always interested in what spaces tell us about things. So the next piece is about Black ownership in the music industry and in Black performance. And it's a space in New York City, which I think is the last remaining space that ties into that conversation that emerged out of the 60s of how did Black artists start to control their work.
You haven't been doing this very long.
What does that mean?
It's set up for a question. Just saying, you haven't, like, it's a couple of years.
Yeah, 2 years.
And like, you're kind of going out and you're doing your own thing, not worrying about who's going to read it or really what people think. And yet, like that Chappelle piece, getting nominated for National Magazine Award.
I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah, that's awesome. It was deserved. I guess I'm interested in why you think people have responded so positively to your work.
If people have, I'm really grateful for that, because I don't think that anyone is obliged to read pieces that require so much rapt attention. But I do think that you don't see a lot of writing about Black people that's intelligent, that's empathetic, that strives to be vanguard and say, I'm going to match with style the form. So one of my favorite books is Miles Davis's autobiography that he wrote with Quincy Troupe. And the reason I love it is because the colors and the energy that they bring to the story of Miles Davis's life matches the intensity of his music. It matches the genius of his music and the poetry of his music. And also the I don't give a fuckness of his music. I'm this good. So one of the things I always like about reading people writing about their lives is that they control the narrative. And so I think one thing people might respond to is the sense that I'm just trying to honor that sort of thing, mm-hmm. And saying, these people are really good. They deserve good writing about them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is unique in that way. There are not a lot of Black women writing about Black artists in these kinds of publications. That's not like a consistent thing in the Believer or the LA Review of Books or...
No. There should be more.
I agree.
And, you know, so that's like the huge thing that I do think that publishing is just incredibly problematic in that way. And so every time I'm asked to do one of these things, I do want to say it's abysmal and it's really pathetic that there isn't more diversity.
How do you think that changes? Like, how does that improve?
Toni Morrison says something that's really brilliant. And she says, I can't be the doctor and the patient. Okay. Yeah. You know, you change it by hiring. It's not that deep.
Yeah.
So if you have the inclination, do it. There's so many talented people out there. And so, you know, things like the word culture fit and those language, that sort of language, it's really terrifying to me because I do think it's regressive because the thing that I like to do is, you know, I'm really helped by reading books and people who aren't like me. And I think that we all are.
That's a good answer. I want to ask you about being a teacher.
Okay. Yeah.
So how long were you a teacher?
Oh, God. I mean, I've taught all over. So I started teaching my first year out of college and I taught until maybe a few years ago. Not just high school, but I've taught Columbia, all over the place, Eugene Lang. I taught urban studies at Eugene Lang.
But I'm interested in, particularly in, you taught public school.
Yeah.
Taught middle school?
I taught high school. I taught what New York City public school calls special education, a word that I just think is horrible. But so I taught those kids, and disproportionately, they were young men of color. They were absolutely brilliant, and I still am in contact with many of them, or some of them. I have one student who blows me away. She's so successful. She's so on it. And once a year or so, I like to take her out, and we go out to like a big girly dinner, and we hang out and catch up. But basically, what that taught me, I would say if I wanted any audience, when I met those kids, I realized that they were really, really damaged by not having control over how they're perceived and just that they were brilliant kids and the sense of they're just shuttled into this special education thing. So one of the things I always try to do is say, how can you serve up a correction to someone's perception? Because often we see things wrong if we remove context. So you see these kids and you think, oh, this kid's shouting in the classroom. That's the bad kid. No, actually, that's not the bad kid. That's a kid who maybe had a bad morning. And so what can we do to kind of recover that story? And so that's why I really liked it. And I like that sort of work. And I think that's the biggest thing I think about is like a correction. How do you serve it up?
What are you trying to correct in your work? I mean, how does that translate to the stuff you're doing?
Okay, so one of the things I thought about with the Beehive, right?
An essay about Beyonce's fans.
Yeah,
ran Beyonce's on NPR,
fans.
Right?
Right, right. Where I was really, like, exhausted by the language you see of Michelle Obama is so tough. You know, these women are so aggressive. Oh, they're so brassy. And you see this all the time with women of color, that they're so antagonistic. And I just thought, this is bullshit, right? Like, these are women who are dealing with some of the highest rates of domestic violence. These are women who are holding down single-parent households, you know, and it goes back to Sojourner Truth's classic speech of, ain't I a woman? I mean, it's just like, they're doing so much and they deserve to have their femininity protected and they deserve to be understood when they are acting brassy, which all women can do. So what I felt about the Beehive is that, yeah, they do ridiculous things, right? But at the same time, I felt like there's a longing and then Beyonce fills a need. And so often why I think about people in pop culture is not because I'm particularly interested in them, but I'm interested in why people are interested in them.
Yeah, I mean, again, like reading that piece, you go to like a show at Barclays.
Right.
And the beginning of the thing is just being there and watching these mostly women, like, I don't know, like kind of wild out.
Wild out.
like out, they're out. This
yeah,
is like a night out.
Yeah,
they're like
night,
going
yes,
for it.
Yes.
They're fucking going for it. and it's awesome. It rules. But I when I was reading this, like it fit so perfectly. And this happens with the Chappelle thing too. Like like you're dealing with these kind of ambiguous ideas, or at least they're not super clean. You know, it's like there's margin of error in the ideas, and I guess I'm interested in, like, did you know what it was going to be like when you went there? Do you have these ideas kind of fully formed, or is part of it, are you coming to the Beehive and just being like what's the deal with this, like what's going on, or do you know it before you start?
No, I try not to ever think that I know the story. I like the story. I like to follow the story, which is something I learned from this teacher at Columbia, who was the best teacher to me there, Patty O'Toole. And Patty was amazing because I would write these pieces about Beanie Siegel and the RZA. You know, I started working on that piece like my last semester at Columbia, and she writes about like Theodore Roosevelt. But she would talk to me about my work as if she was intimate with it, or as if she cared, or as if it was just about the story.
The RZA, the JZA.
Yeah, you know, like it would be like, right, like talking to her, and she would be like, old dirty bastard. And it was like, yes. But that was when I started to realize, if you nail down very technical aspects of a story, hopefully you can take anyone on that journey with you. So I try not to think about where the story is going to take me. Just that it's my job to figure out what's compelling and to tie it all together.
Sounds about right. Okay, I'm going to blow up your spot a little bit. We were talking before we started, and you were saying that when you started writing, you were only going to do it for like a couple of years. And if it didn't work out, it wasn't going to work out.
Right.
What was the metric? What was the way you were thinking about that? Like, what was the thing? What did you have to do? What did you have to accomplish to keep doing it?
Well, I think what I thought was that it's a little bit arrogant to keep pursuing something that no one is interested in. And so if I was going to write these things that at some point were just becoming deeply private, then why not just let them be private and continue on? If people didn't get what I was trying to do, which is tell this very, very long history, you know, of how the 21st century connects to the 20th century, the 19th century, the 18th century in Black America. And I come from a family where they're taskmasters. And so there's not a lot of do things for pleasure or leisure. Right. So it's like, my mom.
Go find yourself and write it for 10 years.
Right. Like, my mom's a single mom. There's no safety net. You know, like, it's like people hear, oh, your mom's a professor. It's like, okay. But professors don't pull in a lot of money it's like, what are you talking about? So, yeah, I was privileged in the sense my mom had books around. But at the same time, my mom raised her kids on her own, you know? So there's a sense of always, what are you doing? And that's the question I guess I constantly ask myself, and who knows? You know, I don't think of myself as a writer. I think of myself as...
I'm really surprised to hear you say that.
I just don't. I think of myself as someone who writes. But I think that you don't do it for other people, you do it for yourself. So at the moment other people don't want to read it, I don't know what the point is of continuing.
Well, if you don't think of yourself as a writer, what do you think of yourself as?
Oh, someone who writes, someone who teaches, someone who reads.
Reading is a real part of the profession?
Reading is a huge part of the profession. I really like to read. I mean, we can talk about books all the time, but I mean, I love books. I like all sorts of books. You know, I tend to really like Russian literature, which is really weird, but I sort of like the way people work out their anxieties and their failures in writing, and that has always been seductive. So I like to know that other people have walked this road.
Rachel, thank you very much for taking the time.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Long Form. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Jenna Weiss-Berman. Our intern this week, Tim Maddox. Thanks to our sponsor, Tiny Letter. And thanks very much to Rachel Kadziganza for coming in. If you have not read Rachel's stuff yet, you should remedy that. There's going to be a lot more of it soon. And you're going to want to read that too. We'll see you next week.